Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Early voting in the primaries is underway through the end of the month, with Election Day on March 3rd. There are some important races, not just for North Carolina, but for the nation. On that ballot, at the top of the list is the race for U.S. Senator. On the Democratic side, former Governor Roy Cooper tops the list of candidates. On the Republican side, former head of the RNC and the state GOP, Michael Whatley, leads the pack with the endorsement of Donald Trump. Democrats hope to regain control of the Senate, and if they want to realize that dream, Cooper's win is likely a must. And there are House races to consider at the national level and some party switching at the state level that have some people up in arms. Then there is the letter received by almost a 250,000 North Carolina voters telling them their registrations may be lacking. And of course, the primaries are important here because some of the races are uncontested. The winner in March will win in November's general election. This hour, a deeper dive into the importance of this election cycle, what we can learn from the outcome, and what, if anything, those outcomes say about the results in the upcoming general election in our state and beyond. We're joined by Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of the book Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. And Brian Anderson joins us. He's a politics reporter for The Assembly. Welcome back. Good morning.
Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. So, as of this morning, and these numbers keep changing, but as of this morning, according to Dr. Cooper, which is the latest information that I have, early voter turnout is 332,672 votes cast. Some of those votes have been rejected. We can talk about that if you want. And in parts of the state, including Mecklenburg, voting turnout has been described as steady and strong. In Forsyth County, turnout, at least as of last Wednesday, was nearly double what it was in 2022. Any theories, Dr. Cooper, as to what's driving this? Is it the Senate race? Is it disappointment with where we are in the economy or the Trump administration? Something else? What is it?
All of the above. Can I just go with that one? I mean, it really is a bunch of things going on, right? I mean, at one level, more people live in the state than lived here in 2022. We have more registered voters, right? So you'd expect to see increase. I think number two, we've seen an increase in the number of people who want to use in-person early voting. Let's remember, we don't know what voter turnout's going to be like in the end. We know what percentage of people are casting their votes early. And I think the third thing is 2022, remember, that was the election where the primary moved, right? So it started in March and then it moved to May. And I'm sure that led to some confusion amongst folks. So some of it's those big factors that are less interesting to talk about than the races, but I do think matter and are worth thinking through. And then we do have some really competitive races going on, right? So the Democratic primary and NC4, Durham County turnout is through the roof right now, particularly on the Democratic side. Of course, State Senate District 26, the Berger Page race, is seeing big, big turnout, particularly in Rockingham County. So there's some specific drivers, and then we have these kind of overarching factors that are more boring, but also important.
And I have some raw numbers here, but these raw numbers are from last week. 38,000 plus Democratic ballots cast, almost 27,000 Republican ballots cast, 27,000 unaffiliated voters choosing which primary to vote in. But you gave me some numbers this morning. 43% of the ballots cast have been Democratic ballots. 28% have been Republican. 29.5% are what? Unaffiliated. Which way are they voting?
Yeah, this is a great question. And Brian's got some data on this too. Okay. But statewide, it looks like most of the unaffiliated voters, a slight majority, are going to the Democratic Party, right? It's about 52% roughly of unaffiliated voters are choosing the Democratic primary. But we see like this really interesting variation. So let's grab those two races that I think that everybody thinks are so interesting. At the congressional level, in NC4, you're seeing almost 90% of unaffiliated folks choose the Democratic primary. But in that state Senate District 26, the Berger Page race that's now so big that it's being featured in the New York Times, right? We're seeing unaffiliated voters choose the Republican primary. So I think that's a couple of things going on. One, Rockingham County and that part of Guilford are more right-leaning than Durham, certainly. But also, I think voters are getting the message. If you want your vote to go where the action is, if you're in NC4, you're going to go to the Democratic primary. You're in State Senate District 26. You're going to go to the Republican primary. We see those kinds of patterns playing
Yeah.
out statewide.
Brian, you want to chime in on that?
I was going to say there's about a 10 percentage point difference among unaffiliated voters casting ballots for Democrats over Republicans. But again, that's statewide. You really have to look at the differences by county because we always like to say every vote counts, but not every vote matters equally in this cycle. So if you're in Wake County, like the difference between a Republican ballot and a Democratic ballot could be like voting in two races versus half a dozen races. So I think what we're seeing is unaffiliated voters really making a conscious effort in our open system to cast a ballot in the primary with either more races or, like Chris was talking about, those very, very consequential contests like Berger's race.
And there was an article in your publication, Brian, The Assembly, headlined, ICE has taken over Democratic primaries. One candidate says that given the Trump administration's aggressive deportation tactics, campaign strategies have flipped and that everything has changed. Is turnout and higher numbers of people voting in Democratic primaries being driven in some part by disgust with those tactics? Is that eclipsing what many Democrats thought would be the issues? Inflation, the cost and availability of health care, resistance to autocracy? Is it all about ICE, really?
Well, I would say it's a combination of things. And first of all, I think the most important thing to note is that we are very early into primary and in-person early voting. We also tend to see early voting in person at its highest, the first 2 days and the last day or two. So the jury's still out on what overall in-person early voting turnout will be. And then we also don't know what election day turnout will look like. So it's a little too early to say, but I think what we can say in some of the numbers that we've seen so far is there's in Mecklenburg County, for example, where immigration is a hot button issue, in Durham County, where that's a hot button issue, especially in the 4th Congressional District, that it's certainly a subject that's motivating people to come. But whether or not it's the only thing, I don't think I would say it's the only thing, but it's certainly a more important factor depending on which county you're talking about. And I think the numbers reflect that in a couple of the counties, but I can't put myself in the voter and say that's exactly what's driving them.
So, Chris, the leader of the Republican Party, Donald Trump, decries the legitimacy of mail-in ballot voting, although he votes by mail. He also decries the legitimacy of our elections, and that's reflected down the scale because he's the leader, and everybody seems to be marching in lockstep. So, could it be that? And he also believes that election day should be election day, period. So could it be that a lot of people are casting Democratic votes because more than Republican votes because Republicans are waiting for election day?
Yeah, absolutely, that's possible, right? And we've seen evidence of this. It didn't used to be the case that mail ballot was this Democratic thing to do, right? Prior to Donald Trump, it was actually Republicans, not Democrats, who cast using mail ballots more often, right? You saw a lot of the what we call Uecava voters, which are usually military folks stationed overseas. They tended to lean a little right. But then when Donald Trump started saying, hey, I'm not wild about this mail voting thing, you saw two things happen. One, the Republicans say, okay, great, I'm not going to use it anymore. And the Democrats almost giving a middle finger saying, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to start using it more. And so you saw this big change. Yes, COVID had a lot to do with it, but I think you're exactly right, Mike, that what Donald Trump says in terms of not just who to vote for, but how to cast that vote has been pretty effective. Now, in North Carolina, there's a little pushback on this, right? So last cycle, there was this group called Bank Your Vote, and their pitch was essentially, hey, it's good for the Republican Party for people to cast their vote early because we can frankly spend less money trying to contact you. And it did appear that Bank Your Vote worked, right? So this last cycle, we saw Republicans claw back a little bit in terms of early voting, right? So that big Democratic increase kind of came down a little bit in 2024. Like Brian said, we don't know exactly what the end of the equation is going to look like until election day happens, but I'm very curious to see, kind of what the Republicans are doing. Are they just waiting for election day, or does this really signify, as we're also seeing in Texas, just Democrats fired up?
We've talked about this before, I think, Brian, that in primaries, at least here in North Carolina, voter turnout is generally low. It's particularly low in Mecklenburg County. I think we have among the lowest voter turnout of any county in the state for whatever reason. But we keep getting reports that turnout is steady and larger than normal. And this is an off-year election. It's not a presidential cycle. Do we have any idea why voter turnout is normally low and how this year compares to previous years?
Well, what we know this year that's different than the past is just kind of the number of competitive races, I would say. You know, we have in Mecklenburg County, Carla Cunningham's legislative seat, Nassif Majid's legislative seat. You have even a contested primary among Republicans for Tricia Cotham's seat from someone who one would reasonably argue isn't a true Republican, who switched parties late last year to join the GOP primary. So I think on the legislative side, you see a lot of Republicans motivated to vote for Cotham over someone they see as a Democrat trying to hijack a GOP primary. And then on the Democratic side, you have contested primaries, including a race where Governor Stein has weighed in. We haven't seen governors weigh in on Democratic primaries in MEC before. To this level, you know, we had other former governor, I almost said former governor Chris Cooper, former governor Roy Cooper weigh in on Kirk Devier's primary, and that got a lot of attention, and that was a key race in Cumberland. So I think what we're seeing in MEC that's different than the past is just more contested races might bring out more voters. I say that with the caveat that it's very well possible few people vote on election day, and I could be saying the opposite thing on March 3rd.
And some people just view the primaries as not important because they'll vote in November because that's when it really matters. But it really matters when there are a bunch of uncontested candidates or just a primary with four Democrats. One of them is going to win the primary, and they said that since there's no Republican challenger, they will win in November. Does that lessen the importance to voters of the primary, or should it be the other way around? Should they see this in some cases as the general?
I mean, it depends on which county you're in, I would say. So if you're in Mecklenburg County, very heavy, heavy Democratic control. The only general election legislative contest that's likely to matter would be Senate District 42 or Tricia Cotham's House District seat. So that's a couple races that will matter in the general, not so much in the primaries. But for the Majid primary, for the Cunningham primary, the primary election, that is effectively the general, because whoever wins that is pretty much guaranteed that seat in November based on the makeup of the district. And so I think it really just depends on which county and which district you're talking about.
I take it that if there is no Republican challenger in a district, or there's no Democratic challenger in a district, that once the primary is over, the other party can't mount a candidate against the winner in the primary. Is that correct?
There are some loopholes where, like, if you're an unaffiliated voter and you want to be kind of a third party candidate, you have some avenues, but we really haven't. There's no precedent for that being successful on a key race, I don't think. So if there's no Republican candidate and you're in a Dem seat, you probably haven't. No offense to the Libertarian Party or other third parties, but it's a Herculean effort to win if you're not a D or an R next to your name.
But Chris, is there a regulation against, once the primaries are over, is there a regulation against a party that did not mount a candidate in the primary from running one in the general?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. There is a restriction on that. So as Brian said, they can run as an affiliated if they can get the signatures together. But as far as the party, no, it's over.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk about this shift. For the first time in history, there are more registered Republicans than there are Democrats in the state of North Carolina, and what impact, if any, that apparently is happening on these primaries and what impact it may have on the general election in November. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about primaries, why they matter, and the voter turnout. And this one seems to be particularly strong in many areas around the state, including Mecklenburg, which is unusual for us. We're here with Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science and director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University. Brian Anderson is also here, political reporter extraordinaire with the Assembly. The fact that there are more Democrats voting right, or more more people casting Democratic ballots in this primary so far is happening at a time, Brian, for the first time in history where the number of registered Republicans has eclipsed the number of registered Democrats. Help me to understand this.
Yes. So first, before I had to clarify one thing from the earlier segment, I'd mentioned there was the ICE assembly story that you had talked about, and there was one candidate who had talked about this being a kind of a game changer, saying everything changed. That was a national story, and that candidate who said that was an Illinois congressional candidate. So just wanted to clarify, the ICE issue is a national issue affecting more than just North Carolina, but like the 4th congressional district, that is also a key area where that ICE issue is taking place.
You're right. It's a national issue, but we experienced it here in North Carolina. We experienced it here in Charlotte. Yes. And after Charlotte came Minneapolis, and people in Charlotte, people in North Carolina have televisions. They see what's going on. So there is probably some truth in North Carolina to that comment.
Yes. And especially in MEC and Durham, but yes, for sure. And then to the point of the more Republican registered voters than Democratic voters, we've seen Republicans in the state GOP really tout this as a grand success. And I think overcoming hundreds of thousands of vote deficit over the past decade is there's no sugarcoating it. That's a pretty substantial shift. But that's not just Democrats completely abandoning the Democratic Party and all coming to Republicans, as some are trying to characterize it. Really, it's more of a testament, I think, to this rise of unaffiliated voters and how people are increasingly more frustrated with the state of both political parties. And maybe they're slightly more frustrated with the Democratic Party than the Republican Party. But more than anything, what I think that shift in registration speaks to is the fact that unaffiliated voters are very much, in many ways, if they turned out in the same levels as other state parties, could be running the table in elections.
Chris, you wrote a column about this for the Assembly, which was headlined, Democrats are losing members in the state. Well, you ask, are Republicans gaining? Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. So what we've seen is the Republicans have actually stayed fairly constant, right? So the victory for the Republicans, the thing they should be excited about, isn't that they're rising, it's that they are not falling, right? So if we look at 1988, when the Republicans first opened up their primary to unaffiliated voters, and we compare the proportion of the electorate that was Republican then to now, it's about the same. So what's happening here isn't the Republicans are rising, it's that they're staying steady. And then, as Brian talked about, people are selecting unaffiliated instead of Democratic. Now, I think there's a perception sometimes that this is about party switching, right? So if I say, hey, I'm going to leave party X and go to party Y, that's not the vast majority of this. The vast majority of what's happening is what we call generational replacement. So people at the end of the lifespan, right, when they leave this lifespan and leave this mortal plane entirely, they're overwhelmingly Democrats. And then the people coming into the electorate used to be Democrats in big numbers. Now young people are overwhelmingly Republican. And so what that means is that's the churn in the Democratic Party. This isn't that a lot of people have said, I'm out of the Democratic Party. It's that people are dying and people are coming into the electorate and they're having different kinds of voter registration patterns. All along, the Republicans are just steady Eddie.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, and isn't it true, like, you know, when you go to the DMV, you're kind of prompted, if you're a new out-of-state person, we've seen a lot of growth in the state, that they'll kind of ask you for your party, and if you don't select one, in some cases, the default is unaffiliated, and population growth seems to be driving this too, right?
That's exactly right. So the default is unaffiliated everywhere. So if you just don't fill in that blank, you're going to be counted as an unaffiliated voter. Same thing if you say you don't want to put in your race or your gender, you then go to essentially a third category. And so that is absolutely what's driving it. So the big drivers are new people in the electorate, and that could be people that are 18 and coming for the first time, or people who are born out of state and then coming into North Carolina.
So two questions about that. What if it's young people who used to enter politics as Democrats, now entering it as Republicans, what's driving that? And then somebody asked me this question the other day. If there are more registered Republicans in North Carolina, because we have so many newcomers, and many of them are coming from places like New York and New Jersey, which are traditionally blue states, are they registering Republican when they arrive here because of high taxes that they experienced in those states, and they're done with that.
I mean, really, they're registering unaffiliated. I think as Brian said, right, if you were coming here from out of state, unaffiliated is what you're registering with. It's not really Republican in big numbers. And yes, it's true, a lot of people are escaping New York and New Jersey, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are, but there's just as many, if not more, listeners that escaped Florida, right? A pretty red state last time I checked. So it's not that I've seen this narrative a lot, that it's like people are leaving blue states because of high taxes and they're coming to red states. And to some degree, that's true, like California to Texas. There definitely is some movement there. But in terms of North Carolina, I think the story's a little more complicated.
And what about young people?
Young people are overwhelmingly doing unaffiliated as their option. But Brian was going to jump in there.
As the 30-year-old person here who talks to some fellow young people, I would say what I hear is just a increasing frustration with the state of things. You know, like, we're the generation where we're not going to be better off than our parents. There's this very much frustration with the status quo and feeling like elected leaders haven't delivered. So I know that there were people who had a lot of hope for President Obama, but felt a slow recovery in 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. And those young people growing up in that might blame the Democrats for not being equipped enough to fix that. And then there was similarly kind of that moment in 2021 where, you know, you had a lot of hope if you were a Democrat that President Trump is out of office and now everything can change. And then COVID happens, inflation increases. And so when Democrats have been in charge, a lot of younger people, a historically good constituency for Democrats, have felt disappointed. Now, some of that's just partisan gridlock. Democrats don't have universal control of House, Senate, and White House. But a lot of that, you can point to times where Democrats did have all three branches and voters didn't feel they delivered. So I think those factors are just contributing from the people I talk to of why they're transitioning away from Democrats, even if they see Democrats as better than Republicans.
There's a lot of hand-wringing, Chris, among Democrats, that they're losing the thread, that they're not able to articulate a unified message or to attract younger voters or people out of who are independents toward them as opposed to Republicans. But the Donald Trump came in with great promises, none of which have been realized, none. So, and a shift in the world order, and a shift in the way he views how this country should operate, and not as a three-party or three-branch government, but as a single-branch government with him as the dictator of all things. That at least is the impression that he's giving to a lot of people. So is that turning people off? Is it turning them on?
You know, I think a little bit of both, right? So when we say he hasn't delivered any of this, but I think one of the promises of Donald Trump was to break stuff. I mean, it really was, right? He said, hey, the system isn't working for you. I'm going to come in and I'm going to break the system. And I think folks on the left and the right would probably agree that he's been pretty successful in doing that. Now, whether you see that as a positive or negative, obviously, you're going to put through your own partisan filter. But I think his promise of changing the system, breaking the system, has probably been realized. As far as, you know, kind of what people are thinking about it, I think the data are pretty clear, right? His approval rating is low. It's lower than most other presidents have been at this same point in time. We can get into this nerd fight about to what degree approval ratings still matter in a polarized America, but at the end of the day, people aren't as enamored with Trump as they used to be. With all that said, the Republicans are. I'm sitting here to the right of my desk here. I've got a pile of flyers and mailers that I've gotten in this election, and everyone that is for a Republican candidate has a picture of their face superimposed right next to Donald Trump. So I think that tells you all you need to know about what at least Republicans think they need to come out of their primary, which, as you and Brian talked about before, the vast majority of the time, that's who's probably going to come out of the general as well.
I mean, so I think Trump has delivered on some things he said he would do, like immigration. I don't think anyone can argue that
that's true.
Trump came in and said one thing on immigration and did another. And people will probably take exception to what happened in Charlotte and Minneapolis and Durham and see things as going too far. So in some areas, Trump has gone further than maybe people thought he promised. So I just had to point that as kind of the exception.
I'm glad you did, because that is absolutely true. With so many primaries uncontested, not just here, but around the country, I'm sure this is the case around the country, where there's a it's front loaded for Republicans or it's front loaded for Democrats. Does that hurt voter interest in the process itself? You're nodding, Brian. Yes.
I'm in Wake County, and I know depending on your address, you can, if you're in a Republican primary, you might be voting for two people. If you're in a Democratic primary, you could be voting for six people. So, I mean, the people who vote in primaries are, generally speaking, some of the most motivated, engaged, aware voters. And, you know, depending on which district you're in, depending on whether both parties are putting up a fight in those primaries, that can really enhance or dilute the power of your vote, especially if you're in that unaffiliated camp.
So, Dr. Cooper, since you wrote this book, The Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer, nationally, the Democrats want to win back the House. They're pretty confident that they might be able to do that. The Senate may be a tougher struggle, but they have to, in order to do any of that, they have to gain seats in deep red areas. Are we one of those areas? I know we're purple, but we've been gerrymandered to a fare thee well. So are we one of those states where they can actually achieve that? And if they can, what will the overriding factor be?
Right. I mean, I think part of it depends on which chamber, which office you're talking about. I mean, I think for the United States Senate, the Democrats do have a very good chance for a pickup in the state of North Carolina. I don't think anybody denies that. I've yet to see a poll that has Michael Whiteley ahead of Roy Cooper. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're going to see huge money in here. And I think a lot of people are looking at this and saying, well, how can this be, right? So a common stat I hear that's true is that North Carolina has not gone for a Democrat for the United States Senate since 2008. Fair. Absolutely true. At the same time, Senate races don't come up in four-year cycles. They come up in six-year cycles. And if you look at the years when North Carolina's had Senate seats up, they tend to be pretty bad years for the Democrats, right? They tend to, you know, things like 2022, which was obviously during Joe Biden's midterm. We look at 2010, which was the worst year for Democrats in the last century. So I think there is a real chance for a pickup here. As far as Congress, I mean, it's going to be tough. The gerrymander that the Republicans did with House District 1 in the northeastern part of the state, Don Davis's district, was a smart gerrymander. And I think they are likely to get that outcome. That outcome, of course, being increasing, not decreasing, the number of Republican seats that we're going to get. The Democrats' best chance for a pickup now, I think, is actually my home district, the 11th Congressional District. But this is far from a gimme, right? We have not had a Democrat represent this district since Heath Shuler, a name football fans may remember. Other folks may not. It's been a minute. We've had Mark Meadows. We've had Madison Cawthorn, most recently Chuck Edwards. And so it's going to be really tough for the Democrats to have pickups in the United States House in the state of North Carolina. Even if they pick up the 11th, if they still lose the first, obviously we're at a wash. That's not much of a pickup.
So I was watching the closing ceremonies for the Olympics last night, and already they're promoting the Olympics in France in 4 years and the Olympics in L.A. in 2 years. And I remember when the Olympics, both of them, came in four-year cycles at the same year. And I know why they split them up now, but it makes it less special. I have to tell you, when you see an opening and closing ceremony every 2 years, it's not the same as waiting for it for 4 years. We have elections every year in Mecklenburg County. Every year we have primary elections like this with the congressional candidates every 2 years. And we have a primary in March for a general election in November. People were 1 year into Donald Trump's presidency, and already people are running for president. So are our election cycles too long? Too frequent? Why do we have a March primary for a November election? Why isn't it in August or September?
Dr. As a reporter, it's crazy too long. I was just going to say,
something to write about.
Yeah, I was joking when I came on board with the assembly in 2025. Like, yeah, we can start. The legislature's wrapped up in like August or September or October effectively, and we have to transition to election coverage when the general election's more than a year away. So, I mean, we're in this perpetual election cycle. And I think what's weird about North Carolina is you have municipals in some counties in these off-year cycles, which I'm sure might contribute to some voter fatigue over in MEC and some other places. But it's not going away anytime soon. And we've seen even a push for North Carolina to go even earlier, like in the 2028 presidential cycle. North Carolina could potentially be the first or even higher in the cycle to have even more influence. So we could be talking about even longer cycles, Mike.
That's what Anderson Clayton wants. She is the chair of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, and she wants to move the primary in 2028 to make it the first. That's traditionally gone to the state of New Hampshire, although, as a thank you, a tip of the hat to South Carolina for pushing Joe Biden over the top in 2020, they kind of moved their primary up. Now we want to move it up, but isn't that under the control of the Republican-controlled General Assembly? And are they likely to say yes? Because if they have their primary, the Democratic primary, early, wouldn't the Republicans have to have theirs early too?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be really difficult for the Democrats to pull off. So let's think about it for a second. First, let's just kind of, to your question as to how we got here. Actually, I'll grab the first part. Yes, we have too dang many elections in North Carolina. So I'll go ahead and go there first. How did we get here? We used to have elections in North Carolina in May. And then in 2016, we kind of tried this earlier election. We said, hey, let's give it a shot in March. And then we flip back again into 2018. But, and this gets really confusing, in 2017, the North Carolina General Assembly said, you know what, maybe we should move us to March. But let's hold off to do that until 2020. Why did they do that? Well, Darren Jackson, who was the House Democratic leader, says the stated purpose of the bill is to make North Carolina more relevant in the presidential primary process. Like, pretty clear what Darren Jackson wanted, and that's what we tended to see from the General Assembly, right? So this was a choice we made to go early. The other logic was, you mentioned South Carolina, and we used to actually tie our primaries in North Carolina to South Carolina. We said, hey, we're going to be within this space of South Carolina's primaries. So let's mess with all that stuff. Go to March. Now Anderson Clayton wants to move it up. Either the General Assembly, Republican control, is going to have to agree, or they're going to have to say, okay, we, the Democratic Party, are going to do what we call firehouse primaries. Just essentially say we're going to have this non-binding thing that's not really run by the Board of Elections that we're going to do ourselves, just to go ahead and do the presidential, which is as confusing as it sounds.
Yeah. There are a couple of other things about having these early primaries and these elections every 2 years, and we'll talk about that and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the importance of primaries and how they're operated and what's happening with this one we're in the middle of early voting for. Dr. Chris Cooper is here. He's the professor of political science, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. And Brian Anderson is with us with the Assembly. He's a political reporter there. One of the other things, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one of the other things that these primaries every 2 years have caused, particularly the March primary, is if you're in a member of Congress, a member of the House, you get elected, and 1 year later you have to start running for the primary. You don't even get your feet wet. You don't even know where the bathroom is yet. And here you are running again. Are we exhausting our candidates with these early primaries? Cooper, Dr. Chris Cooper.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think we are. And I think the same thing's true for the General Assembly, right? I mean, we got 2 year cycles. So in December, so they're sworn in January, and by December, they have to make a decision whether they want to run again. Sort of brief historical moment, I promise, but we actually had a chance to change this in North Carolina. We had a constitutional amendment in the 1980s that said, man, these terms are too short. Let's make them 4 year terms. And we, the voters in North Carolina, said, nah, we're good with 2 year terms. I think we were wrong.
So let's talk about the Senate race. That's an important one. The U.S. Senate race is allegedly going to be one of the most important in the country, perhaps the most expensive in history. How much of that, Brian, actually depends on who ends up representing each party? It looks like a clear shot for the two leading candidates in both the Republican and Democratic primaries. But if one of them were to lose, would all of that change?
Yeah, I had a list of 26 primaries to watch. Number 26 on that list was the U.S. Senate GOP primary. It had to make the list because I had some PTSD of not having Michelle Morrow on my list of races to watch in the 2024 Superintendent of Public Instruction race. Mm-hmm. She's running in the U.S. Senate race against Michael Whatley for the GOP primary. It would take a Herculean miracle for her to win, it would seem, at this point. Don Brown seems to be the most viable non-Whatley alternative in many hardline conservatives' eyes, who have in many ways turned on Morrow, including her former campaign manager. But Whatley's still the favorite to win. If he does win that GOP primary, you can expect an obscene amount of money from voters, from organizations, from national political parties to pour into the state. If it's not Whatley, maybe national Republicans adjust their strategy. On the Democratic side, it seems to be a pretty safe bet that former Governor Roy Cooper is going to win that Democratic primary and have a whole lot of money at his side.
So Roy Cooper is allegedly a popular Democratic former governor. Certainly popular among Democrats. How popular is he among independents? Who wants
without
to
Without independents, he doesn't win in 2016 for governor. That was a very hotly contested race, which was decided by less than 10,000 votes against then Republican governor Pat McCrory. And Trump won in 2016, Trump won in 2020, yet Cooper won in both of those cycles, and he couldn't have done that with just Democrats. There was enough crossover from unaffiliated voters. So what we've seen in the public opinion polls that I've seen so far have been unaffiliated and independent-minded voters skewing toward Cooper over Whatley in that hypothetical matchup.
So Michael Whatley is the front runner in the Republican field. He has great experience within the Republican Party as the head of the North Carolina State Party and later on the co-chair of the RNC. He also has the seal of approval from Donald Trump. How would you handicap, Chris, his chances of winning in the primary, 100% or 98%? And second, if he wins, he has no experience as a candidate or as an office holder. So could he beat Cooper in November?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll go 95%. I'll be optimistic for the rest of the field. 95% chance he comes out of the primary. You know, Mike Whatley's almost certainly going to come out of the primary. If that's not true, this would be the biggest polling fail in American political history. I mean, this would be incredible, right? So as far as, you know, him going to the general, can he beat Roy Cooper? Sure he can. I mean, this is, you know, nobody argues it's a blue state, right? We get in this fight about whether it's a purple state, which obviously, you know, might take on that. But some folks say, no, it's more pinkish hue. Nobody says with a straight face that it's blue. So yes, Michael Whatley has a chance. Michael Whatley has a decent chance. I think Roy Cooper is the light favorite, most folks would say. As you said, he's never been in elected office before, which sort of cuts both ways. On the positive for him, there's not much to nail him on, right? He has not taken any real positions that people can rip apart. He hasn't, you know, had any huge mistakes. I think the one thing the Democrats are going to try to say is that Whatley was in charge of Helene relief and that didn't go so well. And we're going to see Whatley say, hey, Roy Cooper was in charge of Helene relief for the state and that didn't go so well. So I think we're going to see Helene come up a lot here. But the fact that Michael Whatley isn't as well known is his problem, but I think to some degree it's also his benefit. And I'll just add one last thing quickly, that this is the brilliance in some way of Michael Whatley as a candidate, that if Michael Whatley loses, they have not taken him out of any current position. If the Republicans had run somebody like, say, Pat Harrigan, you could be taking out somebody who you have great hope for in the future.
So we've been talking a lot on this program about Kelly Van Horn, who is running in the Republican primary for North Carolina House District 105 against Tricia Cotham. Van Horn has been accused of something we know Cotham did, and that is switching parties. But Van Horn isn't alone. In fact, the Raleigh News and Observer says more than 100 North Carolina candidates have switched parties. 26 of them are in the legislative races. Brian, are these folks switching mostly from Democrat to Republican? And if so, why?
So I haven't looked at every single one of those, so I can't definitively say, but from what I have seen for the most prominent races, that would be maybe arguably the Tricia Cotham primary and perhaps the Tim Moore primary where Kate Compton Barr is running has very blatantly and openly said she's essentially a Democrat. I don't know what to make of it. I've heard from state Democratic Party insiders that I've spoken to that they don't like this. They think it makes the Democrats look no better than Republicans, who Democrats have accused of trying to manipulate election voting procedures in their favor. And many Democrats that I talk to see this as playing games for a pointless reason if you're going to lose in these heavy red primaries anyway. But there are other folks who aren't on that list who are genuinely formerly unaffiliated voters and teachers and educators who genuinely view themselves as in the ideological middle and think they have a better shot in a Republican primary. So the people who have switched parties kind of run both sides, if you will.
And of course, Kate Barr and Kelly Van Horn have been denied any funding from the Republican Party because the Republicans see them for what they probably are.
What they say they are, in Kate Thompson Barr's case.
Yeah, wolves in sheep's clothing. But if the state is so gerrymandered, Chris, the Democrats have difficulty getting elected. And if you believe that gerrymandering is a deliberate attempt by Republicans to stack the deck in their favor, isn't it fair game for Democrats to switch parties in the hopes that they might get elected? They might pull the wool over somebody's eyes, sure, get elected, and change policy. And if a Democrat objects to that, is that another instance of Democrats bringing a stick to a gunfight?
You know, I think that the difference is, right, I'm not going to mix the metaphors too much with the sticks and the guns, but I will say, is it fair game? Yes. Is it going to be helpful? No, right? These folks are not going to win. And I think to mangle our metaphor a bit, right, if you're bringing a stick to a gunfight, you're going to lose. And they're going to lose either way. I think it's a very helpful way for Democrats to say, hey, look, it's impossible for us. But if the goal is actual victory, no, this is not going to play out and work in any sort of real way at all. So yeah, maybe it's a great way to get attention, right? So Kate Compton Barr got on the Heather Cox Richardson show the other day, which is like the Joe Rogan of the intellectual left, if you will. So that's a great rhetorical play. She's going to lose to Tim Moore. I think we all understand that.
So even if Tricia Cotham wins, and she likely will in the Republican, well, she will win the Republican primary, she'll have to run against Democrat Ken McCool, mm-hmm, who is a former Matthews town commissioner in November. And Chris, you say the political tides are going to be different this year than they were last time for Cotham. How so, and how much weight would you put on the fact that the people in Matthews did not want the sales tax for transit because they're not getting the Silver Line? I know you live in Western North Carolina, probably sure, don't know a lot about this, but Tricia Cotham was mainly responsible for getting this through the legislature.
Yeah, that's right. Luckily for me, I listen to Charlotte Talks a lot, so I can keep track of what's going on in Mecklenburg County. But look, it is going to be a very different environment. What Tricia Cotham was able to do last cycle was pretty extraordinary. She was actually the only Republican in the North County General Assembly who won in a district that narrowly, but that favored Kamala Harris in the last election, right? So she was... Mm-hmm. She was a unicorn in some ways, and it's going to be a lot harder to be that unicorn in a year that's going to be good for the Democratic Party. I think the Republicans also put a huge amount of money into that race last cycle. My guess, we'll see what happens. My guess is the Republican Party at the state level is going to be a little, they're going to spread the love a little bit more this cycle is my guess. And so I think it's going to be tough for her to raise that kind of sum. She's probably not going to have that much attention for a variety of reasons from the North Carolina Republican caucus.
So one of the other top primary races to watch in the state, it's out of our region, is the Senate District 26 race, where the Republican primary, there's a face-off between the current occupant of that seat, Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger, and Rockingham Sheriff Sam Page. Now, those of us who live in Mecklenburg don't really follow this very much, but there seems to be some bad blood between the two of those guys. It's kind of a grudge match, Brian. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's arguably the most fascinating, messiest, and consequential. It's the reason it was number one on my list of primary races to watch. You have two people who just plain don't like each other. I believe that Michael Bitzer, Chris Cooper said that before, and that's very true. I think the most interesting moment and revealing moment to me in this primary came before it even started with candidate filing. The night before candidate filing, according to a WRAL report, there was an effort by a top senator, Amy Gailey, to try and convince Sam Page to drop out and not continue his run before candidate filing started. What have we seen since then? We've seen a Trump endorsement. We saw a Trump Truth Social post a second time for Berger. So you don't do this if you feel fantastic about your prospects and the amount of money we've seen into pouring for tens of thousands of voters and fighting over this is going to prove to be pretty unprecedented for legislative contests.
The Charlotte state. Observer says this primary, the Berger Page primary, is the, quote, most consequential primary election North Carolina has seen in decades because significant power hangs in the balance. Arguably, Phil Berger is the most powerful elected official in the state, Chris. What happens if he loses?
I mean, it's going to be fascinating, right? And I mean, just to sort of tie real quickly to your point before about Cotham, right? To my local issues and the importance of that. I mean, I think that's what's fascinating to me about this Berger Page race, among other things, is that ultimately Berger will have amassed all this power at the state level, but it's these local relationships and local issues that may possibly come to get him in the end. And if he does go down, if he does lose, it's going to be a change, not just for who's at the top of the totem pole, but for the entire power structure of the state of North Carolina, right? We're talking lobbyists, we're talking campaign consultants, we're talking a whole lot of politicos that have done very well and exercised a whole lot of power based on their proximity to power, namely their proximity to Phil Berger. So if that changes, it's not just going to be changing the person at the top. It's going to mean a lot more than that for our state. As far as who comes next, what that power structure looks like, I have no clue.
I have like 10 seconds here. Is it even a remote possibility that he could lose?
Yes.
Okay. Before we end the show, we have to talk about these 241,000 voters in the state who recently received a letter from election officials informing them that their voter registration lacked certain required identification information. How was that determined, Brian? Why are those letters arriving now, so close to the primaries?
Very quickly, there's two separate issues. There's 71,000 people who have to update their registration to avoid casting a provisional ballot. We're not talking about them. This is a separate issue of 241,000 people. If they do nothing, they're still able to vote normally. That's the important thing to know. So How do you find out which category you're into? I'm still requesting from the State Board of Elections a records request of all the names of those 241,000. Once I get that, we'll share it. But for right now, how we got here was basically a confusing, misleading voter registration form for Democratic and Republican administrations. And then Republicans sued, filed up lawsuits and election protests. And once the Republican State Board of Elections took control, they made some administrative policy changes. That's why the notice went out. But the bottom line, if you received this notice and you're in the 241,000 votes camp, go vote. You can do so normally.
But then there is another group of people that you alluded to who are find themselves in a record collection program called Registration Repair. This affects a different set of individuals. How does that affect them?
So if you are on this registration repair list, you can just Google Registration Repair, State Board of Elections. There's a search tool. You can see if your name's on it. It affects about one in every 108 voters. So your name's probably not on it, but maybe someone you know is if you search them. And what you can do is you can go to a polling site. You can bring your driver's license. That's the most common way to address this problem. And the important thing to know is essentially a voter application made sending such information optional in the past. This is not through any fault of the voter. The state board merely wants to update that information so that way it's not an issue for them going forward.
But if you're on that list, the people who have to go through registration repair, you can't vote? Is that what you're telling me unless you do it?
You can vote. You'll just have an extra provisional ballot to
provisional
cast.
Ballot.
In the municipals, 98% of these people had no problem having their votes counted. So go vote.
Brian Anderson, political reporter for the Assembly, along with Dr. Chris Cooper, political science professor, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, that would be us, a North Carolina politics primary. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.